Welcome to USA Football's Coach and Coordinator Podcast, where top football coaches from around the country share their stories, philosophies, concepts, and strategies to help you get better on and off the field. Now, here's your host, Keith Grabowski.
Coach Fox, my friend, it's great to hear from you.
Great to be here. It's a lot of fun to be a part of what you're doing. It's been a lot of fun seeing the podcast, and it's an honor to be a part of it. So thanks for having me.
Yeah, great to have you here. Well, Coach, let's get into it and start with this question here. Why did you become a football coach?
Well, I knew all along sports would be in my life. I'm the little brother in a family that, we were playing sports constantly. A dad that was playing rec sports, a mom that was even playing softball and volleyball and all those rec leagues around town, and older sister that was a three-sport athlete and the GCC softball player of the year, and really an older brother. My brother Jim is 7 years older than me. That's the overachiever in every way, and I've been his guinea pig since way back. I remember him installing a passing tree with me when he was the eighth grade quarterback and I was in first or second grade. So all along, I've been a part of it. And even in my 30s now, he's a guy that introduced me to podcasts where I get to listen to things in 1.5 times speed. And, he sent me the Romer article to get me thinking about fourth down several years ago. And all along, I've been mentored by people in my family or things like that. But what made me be a football coach is I knew I'd be a part of that. But football is a superior game. With the team interdependence, the strategy, the complexity, the violence and the hitting that I loved as a player. And it's something that I think I could be successful at just by having a workman-like daily flow it just work and working hard day in and day out can make you successful in the game of football. So I was really drawn to football. And why I'm a coach. I've been a part of athletics my whole life. But why am I here? How can I influence as many people when I choose a career in life? There's nothing better than coaching to impact this world. Being a high school teacher, spending every day with impressionable teenagers, then using football as a platform off of which we build young men, making a positive impact on society. That's what it's all about. At this point in my life, there's nothing better that I could invest all this time in. And I get to be around the great king of football while we influence these young men. So I think it was a given from being a little kid I was going to coach, and right now choosing football and being a part of it has been just such a fun way to spend my life.
I know along the way you've had the opportunity to learn in some very good programs, from your college program at Baldwin Wallace to working for Coach Duffy at Willoughby South. Looking at your years in developing as a coach, what would you say are some key things you've learned along the way that have made an impact on you?
You take something from everywhere you've been, from when I was a player for Coach Bob Packard first early in my career, and then Coach Snell's first couple years were my junior and senior year at BW. And in between that junior and senior year, I actually had the summer job of being one of Coach Snell's secretaries. So I'm getting paid hourly to just hang out in the football office and do a bunch of the clerical work in there, but just learn a ton, soak up everything that Coach Snell does off the field. I actually was the assembler of his champions manual that summer. And getting to see the inside out of how detail oriented he is was a major step in the process. While I was a college football player, I would go back to my high school and volunteer as one of the basketball coaches at my alma mater at Willoughby South. So I was getting to coach kids even that young in the sport of basketball. Right out of college, my first coaching job was at Maple Heights High School for Jeff Rotsky, coaching for him for 1 year, and how he just outworks people and is constantly making him and his kids work year round was a great year in development. But then you mentioned it, getting to coach for get a teaching job back at my alma mater of Willoughby South and coaching for Coach Matt Duffy was the perfect thing to learn the game of football. How Coach Duffy learns constantly evolving, staying ahead of people, studying, reading articles, researching, was something I had never really seen. And he's constantly being a part of it. Whether it was when we decided in 06, 07, hey, zone running game is, you know, probably superior. Let's really get good at zone. And he came in with a stack of paper on top of my desk of just photocopied articles of every zone article he could find. And we're just reading and digesting and being a part of it and constantly talking about how to be a part of the zone running game back in those early years. It was amazing. Yeah, sure, we learned zone running game and it's become the foundation of our offense. But how he worked and how he researched was something that, you know, it connected me to, you know, you have it as a link on one of your websites, the mother load of zone run game. All those articles, half of them are stuff that he printed out for me. And you just read and find out the intricacies of every detail possible. And through Coach Duffy and living up in Lake County, it just connects you. And here in Northeast Ohio, you and this podcast are an example of it, just how many people live and breathe the game of football and how intricate and how detailed they are. Every January, the Lake County Coaches Clinic is an example of all the people I've learned from all along the way. You know, the St. Joe's, the East Side to Menor Lake Catholic, the Gibbons coaching tree, and so many of those people up there. When you think about Mentor High School, Menor Lake Catholic, Kirtland High School, Madison, who we banged heads against when we were at Willoughby South, that coaching fraternity up there has unbelievable mentors and people just live and breathe the game and are constantly learning it. And it's brainwashed me to be a student of the game. And whenever there's a question or something new, it's always only a phone call away. So I've been so blessed to be mentored by those people before I had the opportunity to be a head coach down here at Nordonia.
Yes, Northeast Ohio is definitely rich with football knowledge and guys who are willing to share it too. I know for me, you know, it was a similar track, being able to just get out around, you know, Cuyahoga County, Lorain County, Lake County, and learn from those guys. And as you're learning along the way, and I've been able to follow your career a little bit, you start to develop your own coaching philosophy. What are some of the key tenets of your coaching philosophy now?
Yeah, relentlessly pursuing excellence is what's painted all over everything. And that seems vague, but, you know, pursuing excellence, it's got the word pursuit in there. So as a defensive back where you're running constantly and seeking the football and brainwashing yourself that, but it extends to all areas that, you know, we want young men that are great in the community, that are great in the classroom, and you have to be relentless day in and day out. Going after it. Now, we talk about philosophies and offense and everything we kind of alluded to in my development. Offensively, we have some philosophies too that build into that about being relentless, about playing fast, all those types of things. And I think they're all interdependent into, you know, just the mentality of getting better every day and, you know, some of the core values of our program of competition and winning every battle every day, every single day, whatever you're in, do it right and compete at it, improve, be one day better at the end of the day. And then some more, of the softer core values, but love and trust, humility and discipline, and instilling that in our players day in and day out.
You know, I was talking with Navy's head coach, Ken Niumatalolo, and we talked about, you know, how those things really build into a culture, but also how it's intentional. What things do you do within your program that intentionally build that culture of relentless pursuit of excellence?
Yeah, it's amazing that word intentional. I've been a head coach now for 5 years, and early on, you say, how do you build a culture into our team? I would have just said, be yourself every day. Show up, have a detailed plan of how to practice. You know, when you get a new job in January, have a detailed plan of how every day is going to go in the weight room and how it sets the tone of how we work, how we're prepared. That culture of excellence starts in January in the weight room. And it just, by being yourself day in and day out, that culture will happen. But over the years, the word intentional keeps coming up. And that's where, you know, clarifying core values and posting them and talking to the kids. And we've developed a little bit of a servant leadership program where we talk about, love, trust, humility, discipline, incorporated into it. And that's what's going to make you a better man throughout life. And then the competition and improvement built itself into that. How do we implement that? We have to be very intentional about building meaningful relationships. It's all about it. You know, they don't care how much you know unless they know how much you care. You have to have one-on-one meetings. I've learned that, as tough as it is on time management. We have to meet with kids, get FaceTime, say their name every day and make them know that you value them and that relationship. It's funny, as times change, I realize text messages are valuable. Sending a kid a text that they know isn't a group text, that it's to them, is meaningful to them. It seems funny, and I think a lot of us are like, a text is the least personal thing, but to kids, I think it is something. So just using that as a way to build relationships with our kids is something we have done. And I've tried to, really this offseason a lot, use our assistant coaches to do that. You know, in Ohio, we're brainwashed with Urban Meyer's The Power of the Unit and being 9 units strong. We have to give ownership of each group to the assistant coaches and hold those assistant coaches accountable to develop those relationships, and make sure, you know, as a united team, we're building a culture where relationships are what's going to create accountability within our culture. So we have to be very intentional and, you know, be checklist about, hey, have we done one-on-ones with each kid? Have you texted the kid once a week? Have you done whatever? So that's something this offseason we've tried to be way more intentional about, because you use the phrase hold people accountable in quotes. That can be very vague and very blamey, for lack of a better way to say it. You know, you hold people accountable by having a relationship with them and depending on one of each other and creating a culture of trust. And the relationship is at the core of that. I think that's where it really comes down to. Culture is built in single, within each individual person and within individual relationships. And this is very theoretical. So how do you put it in practice? You have to be very intentional about connecting to single kids, connecting to the other coaches on my coaching staff. And it's hard work. It's day in and day out. It's very checklisty. But that's been my focus here in this off season on how to be more intentional and how to improve our team culture.
You mentioned the word competition and how that's important in this too. What things do you do to bring competition into this, you know, outside of the season?
Outside of the season, in our weight room, we try to have something competitive every day. Whether it's in our off season right now, we've even changed it how we, you know, the programming of our thing. We've gone more to the conjugate method where they're competing in max fives and max threes in their lifts every single day, in their core lifts. So it's less, we tell you what to do. It's you're competing to do it. It's almost a testing atmosphere, at least twice a week in our weight room, just in the lifts itself. But all along, we've done things like our fourth quarter Friday, where we'll go into the wrestling room and create competitions. We'll sumo wrestle, we'll stick war, we'll do relay races, bear crawl races, the mat drills that are way more popular at the college level right now. We have to build those things in now to realize that there are winners and losers in every little individual battle. We got to fight like crazy to win every one we can for us to be successful as a team. And that core value of competition better be heard early. For us at Nordonia, one really unique thing we've done, and it's really simple, is at the beginning of the summer, you know, here in Ohio, we have June and July where we get our 10 practices. I consider almost the equivalent of, you know, a college spring ball or other state spring ball. Well, right at the beginning of June, we draft our team in half. We split the coaching staff in half. And they truly, in a competitive way, draft our players into a green team and a white team. And it allows us to, with a school our size, we're Division II in Ohio, you know, the second largest classification. We have about 60-some kids on our varsity team, typically. We're not a two-platoon team where the offense, you know, our players play both ways. So for us to do a true compete period in practice, it can be difficult for us to say, hey, the ones versus the 1A defense, it's really hard to make it truly competitive for a compete period during practice. This green-white draft has made it where we can have a 10-minute green-white competition, and they're playing football in a competitive way, and it's made it fun. And as early as possible, as we can in the summer, we put truly meaningful competitive ways where we keep score and reward the winning team. Just to every single day, they know that they're competing for something.
Mm-hmm. And when does that end for you, the green and white competition?
In the green white game, it'll be Saturday. It'll be the sixth annual green white game. Saturday, the first Saturday of 2-a-days really is when it ends, because then after that you can start focusing on your scrimmages. So we continue that all the way to when it's full contact finally in August. And we ended in a green light, a green white game, where the scores that have built up over the summer get put on the scoreboard and actually influence when teams start behind. And then it culminates in that green white game, which has been a full on inter squad scrimmage, as part of our first week of August.
Coach, I know you guys have built a very high-powered offense. It's capable of scoring a lot of points. Talk to us a little bit about the philosophy behind your offense.
Our offensive philosophy, the cliche name when I had to put it as a clinic talk title is the relentless attack offense. So the relentless that we talked about has to do with pace, but it also has to do with the toughness and the mentality that is, hey, if things aren't going well, who cares? We're relentlessly playing the next play. We are, when things are going well, we're relentless. We're going to demoralize teams because we are coming at you with how we do things. The attacking part of it, yeah, it has a physicality to it, and us trying to brainwash our kids into playing physical football as part of our offense. But the attack has some very specific things in how we call plays and how we decide things. Our offensive philosophy is that we're going to attack a defense as simply as possible. So look at the defense. Line up in a complete formation, the simplest formation you can think of. We're in 3-by-1 open, and we're going to attack your defense. And we're going to do it as simply as possible. So let's have the fewest amount of plays within that formation and get great at them. We're going to start with 4 verts, because if they don't attack if they don't cover the field vertically, we're going to be great at attacking people with 4 verts and try to call it as much as possible and have the threat of 4 verts threatening a defense. A zone running game that attacks all gaps from front side C gap, and we're a spread team that typically doesn't have a tight end. So, front side C gap all the way to backside B gap, and the quarterback read can take care of the other side. So we're attacking all gaps in the run game, and we're attacking the field horizontally with bubble to the field, a backside one-on-one, three-step type things to make sure we attack the field. But we do that as simply as possible. And even our play calling and how we speak, we talk about, hey, this is what they're doing defensively. Let's not be programmed to percentages of run pass or percentages of this. It culminates that way at the end of the season. We analyze it. We get into the Brian Billick type size and scope conversations. We do a self-scout. But when we're calling plays, our philosophy is we want to attack the defense as quickly and as simply as possible. Built into that, a big philosophy for us is we always talk about our best 11, where, with the roster our size, there's definitely 11 or fewer players that are better than the other kids. So let's create hybrid players and try to be as multiple as possible formationally, but in only one personnel grouping, typically. Obviously, there's exceptions to that rule, but our philosophy is to seek to say, these are our best 11. Hey, is it 10 personnel, or we really have one running back and 4 receivers that are the best? Hey, the last couple of years, we've had, he just won a state championship in wrestling, a tough running back. Well, we had the second kid a year younger that was also a running back by mold, but he had enough skill set that, hey, he's our starting wide receiver, but we knew deep down we were probably a little bit more of a 20 personnel team, but we'll be in 10 personnel formations, 20 personnel formations. That adjuster kid ended up being it, where we were way more dynamic than being a 10 personnel team all the time. We didn't have to substitute to do it, so it allows us to play at tempo and hopefully keep a defense on his toes, because we can be in and out of formations without substituting and tipping them off. That's been our goal. And the biggest thing about not subbing is it allows us to go fast. And back in 2005, going fast was a huge advantage. Defenses weren't prepared for it anymore against good teams. They're prepared for our tempo in games. It's less of an advantage than it was. But where tempo is so meaningful for us is in practice. We have to maximize reps in practice. And being a high-tempo team by nature, by default, helps the way we practice and helps us get reps and hopefully get great at those minimal amount of plays we talked about. So maybe got a little too long-winded, but that's our offensive philosophy. That describes us and what we do and how we've been successful over the last 5 years here at Nardonia. In the previous 7 at Willoughby South, when I was doing things with Coach Duffy.
Well, I think that was a very good answer, Coach. And, what I want to highlight there is the part where you say you don't carry a lot of plays, and you mentioned a few things that you do, but built into an offense like that, really, you have a system, and for the coaches, you guys know where to go next. So like you said, you don't necessarily worry about what what the down and distance is. You're seeing things, you're looking for things on the field. How do you work that out and organize that with your staff on game day, where you're able to have a systematized offense like that?
On game day, well, first of all, you mentioned our offense coaching staff. It was actually not intentional, but I have a bunch of Keith Grabowski disciples as our offensive coaching staff. When Greg Poland is our offensive coordinator and John Myers runs our receivers and Tony Buckler runs our offensive line, they're great coaches that do take ownership and know our system extremely well. All of us have our parts and have our input. I'm still the offensive play caller, but Greg Poland up top in the press box, we work very well together because my mindset is we're going to attack. Let's get these guys. And he is much more analytical. He's more in our play call sheet, knowing situations where absolutely we are talking about field position constantly, down and distance constantly. And there's a lot going into all these things. Now, it's not on game night. Our philosophy is like crazy. We are disciples of Brian Billick's offensive game planning and size and scope and practicing the right amount of plays for how many situations you're going to get in a game. And we're prepared. Those critical third down calls are not made on a Friday night. They're made on Sunday, Monday, Tuesday when we're filling out our call sheet. It's in the first down, second down, you know, more vague situations that we're just saying attack the defense and being a little bit more loose with things. On Friday nights, there's absolutely a ton of conversation and input from our call sheet and in the different situations. Most of the comments and the conversation going on is about those situations. Hey, we're in this field zone now. What does that mean in terms of how we treat third down and how we treat fourth down? That's a lot of the conversation going on. And then obviously adjusting to the defense and should we be off of what we planned earlier in the week because of what they're doing to us. I hope that answers your question as far as being systematic. But that's really probably what's going on Friday nights and how our play calling is happening. I'm still calling it, even though we truly have Greg Poland is an offensive coordinator because he's coordinating things. He's scripting every practice. He's, you know, the final construction on our offensive play call sheet and has a ton of input. And we balanced each other very well with him being very analytical and in it, and me maybe a little bit more emotional and you know, just thinking attack and calling it as fast as humanly possible, which is something I believe in. I think the tempo is a big part of what we do and why I'm still calling it into the headset and signalers are signal it as soon as I say it. So when we're calling it, there's minimal conversation in it, but in between possessions, that's a lot of what we're talking about.
And I know you guys have been up tempo for a long time now. You mentioned the advantage really being in practice. How do you balance that tempo with the needs of coaching your guys out on the field?
That's a great question. And the coaching staff is who needs to be communicated to, because I've had assistant coaches, especially when they come on new, or I came to Nordonia 5 years ago and it was totally foreign to guys that were here previously and they had a totally different style of huddle up and we're going to coach in the huddle after every play and really take our time. When we are up tempo and flying, we should absolutely still be coaching on the field every single play. You need to coach and say something to your players every single play. I think people are over applying the whole, hey, we're going to coach off of film, play the next play. We need to get better at coaching cues. You know, Q-C-E-U. I've been hearing more and more about that. Hey, common language, simple phrases that have a ton of meaning to the kids because it's been built up in meetings and drills and group periods. And now we're finally running plays and we script every one of our team periods. So it'll say on the script, we're moving the ball. So they get a sense of, we're calling this play from the minus 20. The next play is from the minus 40 on the right hash, this play from whatever, and we're getting them in the habit of moving forward where we as coaches got to be moving with them. And the O-line messed up. You are barking like crazy in a hurry. Hey, don't forget this, blah, 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 blah. Play the next play. Let's go. And I think there is a tendency to think that I as the head coach or people that have an up-tempo philosophy are telling you, hey, don't coach. And it can be frustrating, but we're letting mistakes happen. You know, they're messing it up and we're just letting it happen and not fixing it. That's nothing could be further from the truth. Remind them but also we have to be very intentional about putting intervention time, for lack of a better way to say it. We were just talking about, you know, before we went on it on recording, talking about teaching, that I'm in the middle of a teacher day right now. But that's a lot to do with it. It's intervention. We have to build in time, whether it's a 5-minute period of recruit walkthrough after team, or it's meeting time. You know, at the college level, they are going to have a meeting and a film session after every practice. For us at high school, and we're not spending as much time, we got to find a way to give some feedback to our players on what went wrong. So we're not, you know, what I think a lot of people give the, we're not going to go up tempo because we need to coach. You need to coach on the fly and coach in a hurry every single play while we're screaming at them to get back to the ball. Hey, we got to do this better. Now get to the ball, play the next play. And it's a fast tempoed way of coaching. I can't, as head coach or the people structuring practice, do have to remember that you have to build in time after practice to fix mistakes, to intervene.
Mm-hmm. With, you know, you mentioned communication being important, and I've seen some of your practices before, and you guys have put the headsets on. Is that still something you do?
Yes, we've become a little bit more structured on when we do it. You know, once we're into the season, Monday and Tuesday typically are way more scripted, whatever. We found a way on Wednesday, and this was important for us as offensive coordinator is scripting based of all of our meetings and our game plan meetings. He's scripting practice. I, as head coach, who is actually the play caller on Friday nights, I can be disconnected from what's being called in practice. And we do a great job of communicating, so hopefully we're hitting the mark. But we built in Wednesdays where what we do is on our practice script is we call a couple openers, whatever it may be, at the beginning. And then how we practice third down on Wednesdays is we put the headsets on and make it realistic, where on our practice script is every other play is 2nd and 8. So we'll practice, you know, play number 5 on our team script will be a 2nd and 8 play that's scripted. They can, whoever's signaling can look in the script and signal it. Play number 6, it's blank and says 3rd down and blank. Based on the result of 2nd down, I put the headset on, have our game right call sheet in front of me, and it's a great way for me, who I'm not scripting anymore. I need that Wednesday myself to call the 3rd down plays at game speed and really connect one more time, where I may be doing head coach stuff, you know, talking to the freshman coach about scheduling, talking to a player about his English class, whatever. I know Wednesdays I'm going to have to be back in and calling the plays in practice during that and not relying on a script to do it. And that's been a day that it truly is game-like in the fact that coach calling it, signaling it, players having to gain 3rd downs and being held accountable and keeping score on if we're gaining 3rd downs. That's been a great way for us to use headsets and make it as game-like as possible on those days, and practicing game-like procedures, because there's a ton of them and a ton of detail into being a no-huddle team that can slow you down, or, you know, it gives us at least one day a week where we're truly calling it game-like at game-like conditions as much as possible.
Coach, we're going to change things up a little bit here and put the focus back on you a little bit. And think back to, and you're still a young coach, but you certainly have learned a lot over the years. But what's a mistake you made as a young coach, and what did you learn from it?
I remember one very specific instance, and I'm still learning it, like you said. Yelling at kids is something I got to work on. And hey, I am not saying, if anybody knows me, I'm enthusiastic. We're going to yell at practice. It's the quickest, most concise way to deliver the message. So I'm not saying that, but the yelling at and the ever making it personal. I can remember it was a playoff practice at Willoughby South. I was offensive coordinator that worked mostly with the offensive line, and we had a practice where our receivers coach couldn't be there for that day. So as I went and was running wide receivers in D, and nothing sets me off more than kids, you know, you yell because of effort or for lack of focus. You don't yell at mistakes. And this was a lack of focus, not giving an effort in any drills. One of our key wide receivers, it was a playoff practice. I took it so personal that this kid, who should be one of our leaders, wasn't taking Indy seriously. You're who we need to be setting the tone for a playoff practice. My mindset at the beginning of practice is this is the day. This is how we're going to finally, I can't remember if it was Menner or Solon, someone, when we were in the Division One playoffs as a big underdog back at Willoughby South. We need this practice to get ready for these guys. And he was, you know, lackadaisical. He's a 15, 16-year-old kid that doesn't get it. And I remember seeing that kid's reaction to me and taking it personal that I yelled at him. And at the time, I really didn't understand, like, how do you not get it? And it gets back to some of that relationship stuff we talked about in terms of culture, that something I'm still continuing to learn. But, hey, we gotta coach kids up. But there has to be a relationship built before you get on kids. There has to be a context. If you're screaming and yelling at a kid and he has no context of why you're screaming and yelling, all it does is turn them off. I can still picture the look on that kid's face when he looked at me all crazy because I'm screaming and yelling during an Indy period. There was no context to, I had it coached to that position recently. I don't know what tone had been set in Indy drills by that particular position coach. And there has to be follow-up. If you scream and yell at a kid, you better pull him aside later and explain why you were so emotional, so he at least understands that. So that's one big mistake. Just yelling and screaming and thinking that's coaching is something I probably did a way more when I was younger. Now I have to realize when I coach with intensity, which I hopefully never stop coaching with intensity, but there has to be a relationship built. There has to be context. And you have to follow up when you coach with intensity in different settings. So that's something I'm trying to continue to learn from going forward.
And you've hit on that quite a bit, Coach, that the relationship is so important. You have to have that rapport with the players. They need to know that you're emotional because you care, you expect more, you know they can do better, et cetera. And you've hit on it several times. It's about that relationship.
Yeah, it's funny, just the John Gordon books that have become so popular right now, that has just hit home over and over again. And it's some good things. We actually did that. You asked, what have we done for culture? One time last year, we rented out Sky Zone for 2 hours, which was some fundraising money. It was an investment. But we let the kids go run around Sky Zone. It was hilarious seeing our big oaf high school kids jumping and playing dodgeball and doing everything at the trampoline park. But we took the kids in groups out and gave them a handout and did 15 minutes at a time, a little excerpt from a John Gordon book about, you know, the word love, which I still think they're looking at me a little bit crazy, but eventually they'll get that lesson that, some of those things that demonstrating you care and that those players care about one another. That's what has to be there deep down, which it seems such a contradiction. My previous question answer was about yelling at a kid. They have to understand that it's because we care, and the love and trust that has to built into all of this. That's what makes the Nordonia football family. We use the word family. We use the word trust. All of this intertwined, and it's complex. So the more we communicate it to the kids, and for me, I think I have to do a better job of communicating to the assistant coaches so they understand that that's what it's about. And that's some awkward conversations sometimes. But I have to keep reminding myself I don't do the greatest job of it all the time. So when I reflect and prepare for something like this, talking to you about it, it keeps coming up and smacks me right in the face that we have to do a better job and be very intentional about building relationships and demonstrating we care.
What's a book that you'd recommend to our listeners?
The biggest book that had an impact on me, and it does get back to some of the yelling and screaming, is Lead for God's Sake by Todd Gongwer. And I'm not sure the pronunciation of his last name, but Lead for God's Sake is incredibly impactful. And, it has God in the title, and you think it might be some like really religious book. And sure, that's intertwined in it, but that's not the focus of the book. Is faith-based. The focus of it is some of the things we've been talking about why we coach and why what we do. That book was incredibly impactful. And Inside Out Coaching by Jill Ehrman is kind of in that same vein about really why we do what we do. And that book was deep, very thought-provoking, and really gets to the heart of why we're doing what we're doing. And it makes you be mature about this profession in a hurry. I thought that book was great. And they're starting an initiative now, the Inside Out Initiative, where I got to go to an in-service by Jill Ehrman and that stuff. So that's been good. More on the football side of it. Do You Love Football by John Gruden is one of my favorites. And I already alluded to it. Developing an Offensive Game Plan by Brian Billick. That book is a must read. If you're an offensive play caller or an offensive scripter, really it gives a definition of offensive coordinator. You're the one coordinating everything to do with offensive football in your program. And it is dry. It is detailed. And it's one of those, you have to go back and read sections one at a time, but it is the foundation of how we practice and has been very impactful on how we do things, is Brian Billick's book.
Coach, I know you're a clinic guy and I see you often at clinics. What's something you're excited about right now that you've heard out on the clinic circuit this year?
The biggest thing I think right now that we're in the middle of here at Nardonia is a ton of the common language stuff with tackling and block destruction. At clinics, just hearing Luke Fickle at Cincinnati talk about what they've done at Ohio State and how he's implementing it for the first time at Cincinnati. And everyone seems to be talking about tackling and, you know, heads up tackle, rugby tackling. So this offseason, every clinic I was at, I tried to find something tackling. And that's what we're focusing on going into this year is common language amongst our whole coaching staff. That when you're square, it's a heads up tackle. When you're at a side, it's rugby tackle, and adapting language, deciding on common language. We're all going to use the exact same verbs to describe the different things because there's so much commonality between all the different types of tackles. It's been a lot of work and a lot of detail that's our focus right now, is to develop a common language on tackling. So by June, we're ready to speak the same language when we truly teach tackling and do tackling circuits and all the different things we do. But every coach, we want to be speaking the same language, and it's coming out of a lot of clinic talk and hearing what everyone is doing this offseason.
Yeah, that common language is so important. That's actually been a key initiative for something we're doing with, you know, what we've rebranded as shoulder tackling. So it used to be heads up and then, you know, hawk tackling. We worked with the Seahawks, the NFL, the AFCA, in putting together the new shoulder tackling protocol and the 22 drills that we have available with that Pete Carroll and Rocky Seto put together for us in you know, working with us. So if you haven't taken a look at that, I recommend it. It's free on our website at USA Football.
I should have taken some time off this offseason. I got to get to your website. You've done all the work for us. That's awesome. And that's exactly where to go, because heads up tackle by your USA Football was great, but it was only when you are tackling someone straight on. The rugby crowd was saying, hey, you're on a side angle more often in the game of football. So that's totally missing the point. But I hear Ohio State talk about rugby tackling the last couple of years. And they kind of, when you're head up and sitting on ISO on the goal line, they kind of dance around how to speak about that. Well, that's what heads up tackling is. The heads up tackling and the rugby tackling complement one another so well that it sounds like that's exactly what you're combining the two, and we're all working there as a coaching profession. So that's awesome to hear that so many people are doing it the same way.
Yeah, and it certainly works, you know, in a state like Ohio where you don't get to put the pads on. There's so many drills within that protocol that you don't need to have pads on to be teaching and executing the tackle. So I recommend that to all coaches. Coach, we're going to jump into our 2-minute drill here. Some real quick question and answers. So let's start with this one. Schematically, what's the toughest defense to face?
There's no such thing. Every scheme has a weakness. I guess the one that surprises us, because I don't care what you run, even the 3-4 with four eyes, that's been new. It's even odd. If we're prepared for it, I think there's a weakness. But if we're surprised by it, I guess is the scheme that we're not ready for.
What's your favorite goal line play?
Inside zone with a block back. So we'll get in pistol. So the running back's running right downhill behind our center and bring a wing back across. So there's no read. There's no anything like that. It's just dive and veer. For old school people, we call it inside zone, but it's coming right at you.
Turf or grass?
Turf.
What's your favorite backfield set?
Shotgun with one back on the side. Gets the most flow in our outside zone play, the base of our offense.
Day game or night game?
Friday nights. I love that atmosphere compared to Saturday day games.
If you had to run your offense from one formation, what would it be?
We practically do. 3-by-1 open. 3 receivers to the field, nice and spread out. 1 receiver to work to one-on-one in the backfield, in the backside, and then a side back to the trips to the field so we can attack outside zone to the boundary. and we're very comfortable in that formation.
What's your favorite quote?
My favorite quote. The one that I think it's most accurately attributed to Aristotle. You are what you repeatedly do. Excellence, therefore, is not an act but a habit.
Should the kickoff be eliminated?
Hell no. That's my favorite thing in life is running down the field on kickoff.
If you could pick one football coach from the past to learn from, who would it be?
I think Paul Brown. I really don't know much about the details of it, but it sounds, you know, and especially here in Ohio, how he was such an innovator in the beginning of the West Coast offense. That, you know, even in teaching and all the things we've talked about, Paul Brown would be incredibly interesting to learn more from and about.
How about one from the present?
It seems cliche and a homer pick, and I'm usually the opposite of that, but Urban Meyer is the guy right now. I was just at their spring practice last week, and they just, you know, obviously they have the best talent around, but they do everything well. How they practice, how they do drills, everything I've observed since Urban Meyer's been back in Ohio is they're doing things right, and getting the opportunity to see them and their whole entire coaching staff. You know, us having one of our former players playing there right now has given us more insight to what Coach Combs is doing coaching that position, and Urban Meyer has been really fun to watch because he's legitimately good at what he does in a lot of ways.
Nice job on the 2-minute drill there, Coach Fox. Here's the final question. What's the one thing you'd point to as giving your team the winning edge?
We've talked about so many different areas that this is a really hard question, because how is there one thing to do? And it gets back to the philosophy. I used the word relentless right at the beginning. So whether we're talking about, you know, practice organization, whether we're talking about kids buying into our culture, kids showing up and setting the tone of competition and improvement, you know, how we teach our schemes, our kids executing, well, all the things that give us the winning edge, really it's just about being relentless, having great time management, and one day at a time, being relentless in pursuing being your personal best. so that's a trick answer, but that's what it is. There is no easy thing. It's just showing up for work one day at a time and being relentless.
Coach, how can our listeners connect with you?
My email address is foxbw20@aol.com. Fox, F-O-X, B-W is in Baldwin Wallace, 20@aol.com. And on Twitter, I'm at Nord Knight FB for Nordonia Knight Football, NordKnightFB.
Coach, I really appreciate you taking the time with us. It was great to catch up with you, and good luck to you along the way this next season.
Thank you so much for having me, Coach. Take care.
Coach Fox had some great things to share with us, so it's difficult to just focus on a few key takeaways, but here's some important ones I think that he brought up. Coaching cues. Coaching cues are so important. Having not just a common language, but being able to be concise with it and being able to coach on the fly, as Coach emphasized. I really liked his 2nd and 8 and then 3rd down and play it concept that they do on their Wednesday practice. The coaches put the headsets on and they have a game-like situation. It allows both the players to get that situational feel for what's going to happen in a game, as well as the coaches having the ability to practice what they need to be effective on game day as well. And the 3rd takeaway that I had is that relationship. Coach emphasized it again and again, and really it gives them the basis to do everything they need to do to build a culture, to build leadership, to get their coaches on the same page, because he didn't talk about just his relationship with players, but also the relationship with the staff and building the relationships that you need to be able to work together and accomplish something, and like he said, relentlessly pursue excellence.
Thanks for listening to USA Football's Coach and Coordinator Podcast. For more resources, visit the Coach Performance Center at usafootball.com.